uyakwazi ukuthumela ama-email na.
We translate for those who can't understand. We write for those who can't hear. We describe for those who can't see. SubT, subtitles and accessibility for film, television and theater. SubT.com. Fred.
This is Natasha Sinjanović for Fred Film Radio.
Fred Film Radio, z vami sam Bor Pruterčić.
Fred Film Radio, sono Angela Prudenzi.
Essa Fred Film Radio, io chiamo Marianne Morissau del Festival di Berlino.
Angela Cerbi per Fred Film Radio, on è al Festival di Venice.
Fred, the festival experience in 23 languages.
Cinephile, you're listening to the Big Fred Tuesday, Fred Film Radio's weekly show on all things cinema with a particular focus on independent filmmaking and the international film festival scene. The show is hosted and produced by me, Matt McCucci. It's official, Radu Juda is definitely on his way to becoming one of today's top festival darlings. It was only a few weeks ago that his improbably titled Bad Luck Banging or Loony Porn was announced the winner of the Golden Bear at this year's Berlinale. Now, news just in, his new feature film, Uppercase Sprint from 2020, has been given the award of the Bulgarian Film Critics Guild at the Sofia International Film Festival in Bulgaria. That festival took place from the 11th to the 21st of March, with screenings in cinemas at 30% capacity. The main prize of the SFF is known as the Sofia City of Film Grand Prix, and it went to a Brazilian feature named The Pink Cloud, which also marks the directorial feature debut of Yuli Gerbaze, so congratulations to her. Speaking of which, the co-production market at the Sofia International Film Festival also took place, and we're going to be finding out all about it from the head of Sofia Meetings herself, Mira Staleva. We're also going to inaugurate our coverage of this year's Vilnius Film Festival in Lithuania with an interview with Israeli filmmaker Oren Gerner, who is presenting his film Africa there. The Vilnius Film Festival, by the way, kicked off on March 18 and will run through April 5th and is taking place online in response to the coronavirus. They're doing some interesting stay-at-home stuff there, but I don't want to say anything wrong, so I promise you we'll be speaking about it in the next few days a little bit more. For now, let me also tell you that we will be speaking with Martin Thorsson, the Icelandic filmmaker whose new film Backyard Village premiered at the Santa Barbara Nordic Film Festival or film competition in the United States. Goodness, it's really hard to keep track of all the different nationalities and geographical locations that we represent on the Big Fred Tuesday, but that's also what we're all about. We've got more goodies coming up as well, so fire up on Audiotini, sit back, relax, and listen to the audio waves as they fly through the air.
Fred.
Joining me at this time on the Big Fred Tuesday is Oren Gerner, director of Africa, which is a film from Israel and is screening at the Vilnius Film Festival. Oren, welcome to the show.
Hello there, how are you doing?
I'm good, how are you?
I'm great, I'm very glad to speak with you, and very flattered, so thanks for having me.
Oh, I'm happy to speak with you too. We're going to be talking about your film, Africa. So very briefly, for the listeners who are not familiar with it yet, and we'll get into it a bit more later, it revolves around a man who is a former engineer and who is kind of slowly but surely coming to terms with aging and just getting older. And as he does so, he's seeking purpose and meaning. But I was reading that the lead actor in your film is actually your father, is that right?
Yeah, that's true. Most of the cast in the film, the actors are my family, my parents, my nephews, my brother and sister. So it's kind of a family film in a way. And and many other actors are people from my village, so it's kind of a big community film in the making. Yeah.
So is this a case of fact and fiction, the line between the two of them blurring?
Yeah, that's true. It's I would say that at the basis of the film and narrative are biographic, and it's based on the family, on the life of my family and the life of my father, but it was also structured in a dramatic way. So I could say this is kind of a mixture, and it's also a question of who you ask. I mean, if you ask me or my father how much is real in our opinion and how much is fiction, I guess we might give you different answers, and that's fine. I mean, everyone sees this film in a different way and the relations to reality.
Sure. But I mean, when you were kind of working on the screenplay for the film, did you have any research planned with your father? Did you do that as well as part of just putting the film together?
That's an interesting question. I mean, it was a very interesting process because, you know, as a part of the pre-production, I came with my cinematographer, Adi, and we did some kind of documentary research. And it's a weird thing to do with your own parents and your own home. I mean, as a part of the screenwriting, I did. I also did some kind of an interview with my parents. I put the, like I asked them to sit down, and I placed the camera in front of them, and I kind of interviewed them, like you interview me, regarding the topics of the film. I mean, of course, I know them very well, but I also ask them many questions that I never really ask them as clearly, and it helped me to understand the universe of the film a bit better. And also, for a while, me and my cinematographer just filmed them in their house and in their work, and so it was kind of a documentary research process that was eventually formed into a narrative structure.
All right, so returning to the title of the film, what does Africa represent in this movie?
So, first of all, there, I would say in the beginning, it was not, I didn't plan to call the film this way. I mean, it had a different name. And actually, while I was writing the film, my parents actually went traveling to Africa. And then they came back, and as part of the tradition, my father told me to come and see all the things they filmed there, like few hours. And I was like, okay, again, let's see. And I just saw the materials out of politeness. And then I actually saw some very beautiful images there. And it kind of, it felt like it could be some kind, in some kind of way, it could be a part of the film. I didn't know how, but slowly I realized like that there is a very strong contrast between, you know, the life in our village, which is very, you know, relaxed and civilized. And then I saw their travelings to Africa, and it felt like there is like something else, you know, that they are experiencing there, and a different level of lifeness, I would say, or of livelihood. And it felt like for this character, for my father, it was like, even though he's getting older, there is always some kind of a strong element of life in him that in some way Africa and his traveling represented. And I felt that this name is referring to this kind of energy, to this life energy, to this wild energy that he holds always, and trying to struggle to keep alive always. So this was my idea. And also there are, I combined some documentary footage that my parents took in Africa to the film. So it's also part of the film eventually.
You know, when we think about this concept of, you know, exploring the life of a man, coming to terms with his aging, is that something that you also think about personally?
I'm not sure. Maybe subconsciously, but for me, it was mostly, I was interested to tell a story about, I mean, you know, when I ask myself why I did this film, like there are some conscious answers and I guess some unconscious that I try to discover. And for me, it's a way of communication, I guess, with my parents and with my father. Like to do this film is like also a way of speaking to them and understanding them and allowing them to understand me maybe. And I know I wanted to make a film about my parents, about my father, and this drama of getting older and the meanings of it. And I guess that I did it because this, what I saw in my life and in my encounter with them. So
I'm sure it's a part of what I've, you know, what I have in mind also, but it's mostly because of what I see that's going in their life and my wish to document that and to explore that through their experience.
We'll be right back with Oren Gerner in a moment.
Fred.
And we're back with filmmaker Oren Gerner. We've been talking about his film Africa, which is screening at the Vilnius Film Festival. Oren, so we talked about how your film deals with the topic of aging, but do you think it's important here that in this film, this particular topic is tackled or explored from a masculine perspective?
I mean, I guess that this is this the perspective. I mean, it's and I also keep that in mind. And when I speak about the film, I mean, it's this process of getting older through I would say a young adult that starts to think about these topics, but and the young men. So this is my perspective, and I guess that if my father had to do the same film about the same topic, he would do something completely different. And if my mother would try to do this kind of film through her perspective, through a woman perspective, it would be completely different. So of course, I guess I can only represent my point of view on this process.
Yeah, but even the fact that the lead character of the film is a man, I felt was significant because he finds himself just going from being in charge of certain situations to not being in charge of certain situations. And that, I guess, is something that if you're used to being in that position can be particularly difficult within a changing world too.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, specifically regarding my father, he, in his own life, he was also very used to be in positions of being in charge and in control in his work and in his in the army service. So in many different places in his life, he was in control, and now life is kind of taking control away, and he really needs to readapt to that reality.
Another thing that I wanted to ask you, just getting back to your father, because it is quite intriguing, the casting process, but what was it like working with him? What was his response to your idea of him, of casting him in the lead role? And had you perhaps worked with him before in previous projects?
Yeah, so it was challenging in some ways. I mean, because everything is very, you know, it's kind of sensitive, the fact that everything you say about the character is also about him in a way. And I really needed to figure out how to do it in the right way. And the same thing with my father, my mother as well. But I was very surprised in a good way that he was super professional all the way. Like he acted like a very devoted and professional actor. And most of the parts, like, it was very easy to work. And he always like tried also to do even more than I asked. But there were some points, you know, that I once again felt like, you know, the little kid, you know, because if, for instance, you know, I asked him to do something in the carpentry, like part of the film is his work with wood in his carpentry, and I asked him to work in a certain way with the wood, and he said it's not professional if I hold the wood this way, I need to hold it different way. And so we could argue about something, and then he was like, I was feeling like the dynamics of, you know, being a boy with his father that tells him he's doing something right or wrong. And so it suddenly brings you back to that. So in certain points it was a bit difficult, but most of the time it was very very professional the way he you know, he acted. And it was also a weird thing for me because, you know, we did it on their house where I grew up. So it's the place where, you know, as a boy, as their kid, you know, that's where they told me, oh, you did this and that, go to your room, you know.
and now I'm telling them what to do, like do this, do that. It's just a weird switch, you know, to be in this position. So it was very weird and unique and special kind of experience.
Was it at the same time also helpful? Because I also read that, and correct me if I'm wrong, this was your first feature.
Yeah. It was, I did several short films before. It was my first feature. And it was very helpful, you know, to have your main cast, you know, people that are really devoted and believe in your work. So if someone hears me now and thinking about casting his parents, it might be a nice idea, you know.
Yeah, and you also got the location sorted out, right?
Yeah. I mean, actually, I'm laughing, but it was a real thing I had in mind, because I decided that I don't want to wait. I don't know. In Israel, it takes a while to get sponsored, like to have money from the national fund. So I knew it might take a few years just to get the fundings. And I really didn't want to wait so long because I wanted to make the film. So I thought, like, when I thought of the first feature, I asked myself, what thing do I want to film, and also what film I know I could film, and I mean practically. And I knew that if I'm going to work with my parents in their house, like in the practical aspect, it would be very helpful to make that in a small budget. And we did the film without external budget at all until we had the first editing, and then it was easier to get the fundings because we already had the thing. So it was also a practical kind of thing we had in mind.
So we talked about the theme of aging, but another word that you mentioned earlier was the word communication. And I do feel like communication is an important part of the film, especially between generations. Do you feel that there is a difficulty for different generations to communicate with each other?
Sure. I think that I'm a little bit older than the young generation now, like the teenagers today, but in the film, like Meir, the main character, he has some conflict with the young generation, like today's teenager. And it has like the reasons of like the narrative kind of reason, like the same thing we have in our own village, that there is the older generation that's now getting a little bit off their normal kind of responsibilities regarding the village ceremonies and so on, and the young generation kind of slowly takes their place, and it creates tensions sometimes. I felt this in my village as well, even these days. But there is also, of course, the global international, like universal kind of change, you know, with the progress, like technological progress. And I think young people today, like they're evolving. I mean, in the way, like communication wise, like it's evolving so fast and so dynamic, and the technology is bringing them so many different ideas. And it's true that the older generation is a part of it as well in some way, but still I feel today the gap between these generations is even bigger than before because of that technological and the social network and everything. It's kind of strengthening this gap of communication.
And where do you think cinema stands in these times of change?
That's a good question. It feels, I don't know, like there, of course, I feel, and I, some of my friends are kind of, you know, saying like the cinema days are numbered, you know, but I feel that it's not gonna, like the streaming and the, and all the, you know, the iPhone, watching habits and so on. I don't feel it's going to replace it. It's just something that's added, you know. It's like television did not replace theater, and cinema did not replace, and so on. Like, I feel it's something that is going to be changed, but I still feel cinema has its own place, and it just means that we as in like filmmakers, we should take this in consideration and understand that many of the watching habits are changed, and it would be a good idea to have that on mind when we create our films and understand who are we creating for, like, and understand if, like, if we want to approach younger generations, we don't have to, but we need to understand that it's very different. The what kind of media they're absorbing, and what kind of and where do they observe them? And I think it will help us to be more relevant and better filmmakers as we progress as well.
Oren, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you very much for joining us.
That was my pleasure, and thanks a lot. I really hope you will watch the film and let me know what you think.
Fred Film Radio.
Daniel Brühl, the actor best known for his work in such films as Goodbye Lenin and Inglourious Basterds, presented his directorial debut at the Berlinale 2021. The film is called Next Door, and Chiara Nicoletti had a chat with him about it. Here's a clip of that interview.
I wanted to know, in a sort of existential question, what came first, the desire and necessity of stepping behind the camera, or the urge of exploring the contradictions on modern life, popularity, fame?
I'd had the desire to direct something for a long time, and I knew after all, everything I'd heard from directors who were always telling me that you have to really know what you talk about in your movie, especially in your first one, that I was, you know, always thinking about an idea that would be, you know, personal, that would be, that would affect me, interest me, fascinate me. And then one day, sitting in a tapas restaurant in Barcelona, I had this idea. It was actually born in Spain. And then I couldn't do it in Spain for various reasons. Main reason was that I cannot write well. And then some time passed, when I moved in Berlin from one apartment to another, to a situation where I live at the moment, where you have the typical Berlin backyard situation where you look in a lot of, you know, rear view windows. I thought it would be even better and more, relevant and interesting if I would transfer it to Berlin. Still, I had the problem that I cannot write. So, I found a production company that I joined, a distribution company, Warner in Germany, offered me the possibility to also direct something. And I was asked if I had an idea. And then I remembered this one again. And then I took all my courage and approached a friend of mine, Daniel Kielmann, because I knew that he would have the realm, and he's, you know, the best writer we have in Germany. And because he's half Austrian, he might be also have an interest in the darkness, in that dark sense of comedy that I wanted and that the Austrians have, some of them. So I just tried it, and thank God he engaged immediately and was very enthusiastic about doing that. And then we, started to write. Well, he wrote it, and I, fed him with ideas. And then after a couple of weeks, I had the first draft, and then I thought, like, I have a movie in my hands, and hopefully I can make it.
How much of the film is based on some self-obsessed colleagues that you met? I recall, for example, the scene in the film where he thinks that the couple he meets wants a photo of him. How much this is based on real life?
It is funny that you mentioned that, in Barcelona, it was a Swedish couple that approached me in a park. They were both blonde and looked like Germans from the distance. And so they came with the camera just towards me, and I thought, okay, they might be Germans. So the first thing I did was hugging the lady, and then they said, we don't know you at all. We are from Sweden. We want a picture from us. So that was, for example, a funny incident that I experienced for real. It was highly embarrassing. In this case, it is very personal. And deals with many things that I've lived and experienced. But it was not my intention to do a self-indulgent autobiographical tale about me, but it just helped me to tell a story that I wanted to tell, because my persona and my profession stands for something that is very appropriate to be attacked by another character in the movie, who is also a combination of people that I have been observing and met, and who also stands for something. I didn't want to empathize or sympathize with one or the other. I also didn't want to betray one or the other. But I just felt that I was at ease to tell something about characters, and especially my character, that I know very well, a place that I know by heart. So all the way through, I felt like I know what I'm talking about. And it could have been an architect from Düsseldorf, or a politician from Hamburg, or what a successful musician from Stuttgart, whatever. But I just always felt that it is much better if I create it around my real experiences. When the idea was born, I knew that I liked that idea, because I like Kammerspiele in general. Because it's fun to watch actors, play out their roles in such a, limited space and scale. But it was really a lot of work. And also, thanks to Daniel Kehlmann's brilliance and ideas that he had, we managed to tell a story which is engaging enough so that the audience will hopefully feel entertained, in these 80, 90 minutes in this room. Yeah.
To listen to the full interview, check out fred.fm/UK.
Fred Film Radio.
Joining us at this time is the head of Sofia Meetings, Mira Staleva. Sofia Meetings is the co-production market of the Sofia International Film Festival, and I'm happy to talk about this year's edition, which just took place. Mira, welcome to the show.
Hello, Matt.
It's a pleasure. We talked last year, but it has been a while since we talked. And so I was wondering whether we could just start quite simply by, would you be able to remind our listeners what Sofia Meetings is?
Yes, just to say that it was quite a turbulent while. Because since last year, so many things didn't happen the way we expected them to happen. So we had to adapt. But as a film industry, we are flexible. And Sofia Meetings, it's a co-production market in frame of Sofia Film Festival. We had its 18th edition till yesterday. And what we do, basically there are two main models. So one is a presentation of projects of upcoming directors, first, second or third fiction project of directors, and works in progress. And beside that, we have many industry events, discussion panels, case studies, conferences. So it's quite intense, especially this year. Everything virtual, but I'm quite happy with the program and with the participants, and really very important teams were tackled, because we are also partnering with EuroVOD, with Europa Distribution and with Europa Cinemas, meaning the exhibitors, the distributors and the streamers were present at Sofia Meetings, and at several panels we were discussing exactly how the market is shaping, what's happening, because of we won't wake up in the same world and we would expect much better world. We should be prepared how to make it working for us.
Right. Exactly. Yeah, it has been a challenging year. Last year, Sophia Meetings was essentially split into two parts. This year, you were able to make it all come together. Everything took place from the 17th to the 24th. In fact, we are recording this interview the day after it finished. But yeah, speaking of those challenges, I mean, did you find that it was any easier this year after the experience from last year? How did it all take place?
I wouldn't say that it was easier. In a way, maybe we are a little bit more at home in the virtual space, but it was kind of double bigger and triple richer as a program. So it wasn't that easy, but at the end of the day, I'm quite happy with what happened. I mean, we had very interesting speakers like Jeff Gomez, who is basically transmedia expert on brand narrative, but behind properties like Star Wars, Avatar, The Pirate of the Caribbean. Transmedia is very important for me because I consider it like opening doors and horizons for traditional filmmakers. They have to know that they can use different platforms to outreach the audience out there, and that audience you can find at many, many different places and platforms. We also had Beatrice Krüger, one very interesting casting director, and we were tackling the theme of the myth of casting director, because actually most of the directors and producers in Central and Eastern Europe are kind of not very used to work with the casting director. And this is something we have to talk about. What is casting director actually doing, and why you need it? But yeah, many, many, many different things. Heritage Films also in partnership with Lucarno Pro and streamers, because I believe that cinema is the language, and for the young generation, they have to learn this language, to go deeper so they can understand it more. And in this process, first, of course, policies are involved, policies of authorities and educational bodies, but then it is about the heritage films, how we can access them. Because all these beauties are kind of not very easy to find. And what it is about some young people which even don't know about their existence. So besides finding them on streamers, which is very important, I consider it very important to be complementary, that we have to find them in cinemas and to work together, the streamers and the cinema theaters, to work together. So they kind of keep the vibe of the heritage films alive. Keep the knowledge, give access, but ring the bell that you can find them here with us. So events, first create the interest and curiosity, and then streamers to be able to maintain it. Yeah, what else? Yeah, maybe Zeynep Atakan, she was talking about her career. Zeynep is a longtime producer of Nuri Bilgeceyan, Turkey. So that's why basically I chose her, a woman in Turkey, to talk about the challenges of being one of the leading producers and being so successful. I mean, every Nuri Bilgeceyan film is in Cannes. Sorry. And he's master. I mean, he deserves to be there.
Absolutely. He's one of the greats.
Exactly. But it's really interesting to hear the story of his producer.
Yeah, so it sounds like all of the different aspects of filmmaking, including accessibility, which is great because, you know, on this show, we also cover all of the different aspects of the film industry. It's not just about the making of the films, but it's also about accessibility, particularly at a time like this when, you know, it really becomes part of the discourse, and it should be part of the discourse. Yeah, but just returning to the two separate modules that Sophia Meetings, you've got the feature films, pitching and the working progress. And so this allows us to kind of give a glimpse to what the filmmaking aspect of things has been during a difficult time in the pandemic times. Have you found that the level of pitches has been impacted, or the number of pitching too has been impacted by the troubles that we've been undergoing in these COVID-19 crisis?
Not really. I don't think the pandemic times impacted the level of the pitching and the teams even. I think it had a strong impact on the emotion we meet each other, even in the virtual space. You feel it much more like a community, which really needs each other. We need to share, to make better films, to build the stories together. And you feel the joy of communication. And you know what I was thinking and actually talking about with Europa Cinemas, that I think we have to reconnect with our audiences in a different way once the world comes back to normality or goes to the new normality, however we call it. Very soon we will have open cinemas. And because there were so many people that missed it, I think even for them, they will rediscover it. And we have to be ready to meet and greet this audience, this loyal audience of ours, and not only loyal audience, but the new one, to manage to attract it and say, yeah, here we are, and we are such a great place. I'm talking now as a cinema theater, as exhibitor, but actually cinema exhibition is such an important part of the whole chain. Although at Sofia Meetings we are presenting projects of directors and works in progress, this future films, they have to reach the audience. That's why they have been created. They will be. But I wanted to say also something else. Yes, we had a new section this year, and that was TV series projects. Because it's definitely the hype in the last years, but not only because it's the hype. I think it's very important for the region, which is not used for co-producing. So basically, besides presenting 8 projects from Eastern Europe, we had several industry panels on this. We had Agnieszka Hołand elaborating on TV industry. And she was, as always, of course, she's extremely inspiring and interesting speaker. So she focused on that, the laziness of the Eastern European talents, in a way, when they're writing, they're imitating already successful formats. And basically, I agree. But all we agreed also that using your imagination, there are so many authentic stories in Central and Eastern Europe that has to be told. It's just kind of really for the talents to be self-confident about their voices. And these stories definitely will be heard. So for the first time, we had partnership with Midpoint TV lounge and feature film lounge. So basically, we have been able to provide special consultancies for 3 new projects with David Pope, script consultant from UK. And I'm very happy because actually even these 3 projects that we selected were great. That's the second film of Mirjana Karanović, the Serbian actress, which made amazing first film. And the second film of Ralica Petrova, alumni of National TV and Film School in London. So her first film, Godless, got Golden Leopard in Locarno several years ago. And we have a newcomer, Ukrainian director Helga Landauer, with the 3rd project. So interesting names. Basically, these are the co-production markets to manage to attract talents and to give them proper stage to meet the engine of the industry, the producers, and of course the financiers and the sales and distributors, which will be at the other chain waiting for the completed films. But yeah, I'm quite inspired by all the TV series project that I've heard pitch and we've selected before, of course. Very interesting idea. I see a lot of talent.
We'll be back for more in a moment.
Fred.
We're back with Mira Staleva for the second part of our interview to talk about this year's edition of Sofia Meetings, the co-production market of the Sofia International Film Festival that took place from the 17th to the 24th of March. And Mira, I'm just looking at some of the titles and projects pitched and presented, and I see that they come from various different parts of the world. And I also see a great diversity of geographical locations as well as stories. So diversity is really key here.
Absolutely, yes. First, we have never been, as a market, we have never been focused on regional approach. I mean, of course, we are always trying to promote and care about the Southeastern European talents because of many reasons, lack of infrastructure, lack of proper education on the same standards as Western Europe. But beside that, we are open to all the European countries and not only. We traditionally have very good relationship with the talent from Russia, Georgia, Armenia, Turkey. I mean, the position of Bulgaria and Sofia is on the crossroads. And maybe it has minuses, but it has many pluses. You kind of are tolerant. You grow up tolerant to the cultures on the west and on the east. It's a nice mixture. So I definitely consider it as a big, big plus. But as you were saying, diversity definitely. I mean, we had projects from England, from Ireland, from Germany this year. For example, that's the production company of Wim Wenders, and they came with a great project. I will be gone in June. And the project even got some awards. But of course, I mean, awards are very important. But let's say every time when we talk about art and films, award, I mean, it's not Olympic Games. So basically, ideas we can never, never, never award. Ideas touch your heart. They open your mind and emotions. So it's about the beautiful stories. So competition is, maybe that's my personal thing. But if we can help somebody, we help. So that's the awards at the co-production market for. If we have partners which are interested to invest in good talents, here we are to facilitate that, basically, and to help inspiring films come to see the light of the world. And I actually wanted to mention that we had great selection this year. We had, for example, Oleg Sentsov's new film, which is almost completed. Reno, yes. Basically, 10 years ago, Oleg presented it at Sophie Meetings as a project. It was, he just had his first film selected in Rotterdam. I met him several months before. So I said, I read the project, I liked it, I invited Oleg, and very soon after this presentation in Sofia, the turbulence has happened with Ukraine, with him going to the prison, totally unjust. But now he's out and he managed to complete this film. And that's why I'm so kind of excited to because beside that we are creating stories for films, we are going through our stories. Just think about the story of Oleg Sentsov. And then we had the first fiction film by Theodor Ushev. Theodor Ushev is Canadian-Bulgarian filmmaker that has been famous with his animation films. In the last years, he was twice nominated for Oscar, and definitely one of the animation voices in the world. So I think a month ago, there was some Spanish university media, some body made a research, make a questionnaire to critics. So they came out that Theodor Ushev is the most influential animator in the world in the moment. But he's trying different things now, fiction films. We had the two new films by Tonislav Christov. I would just remind that the last film of Tonislav was at Sundance, The Magic Life of V. We had the new documentary by Boris Despodov, Go Back. That's amazing story. Amazing story about people at the border of Bulgaria with Turkey, which are hunting immigrants. And these people have military guns provided by some German groups. Very interesting. But documentaries are amazing nowadays, aren't they?
Yeah. It's definitely, we've been talking with some filmmakers recently that have made some excellent documentaries here too. And it's definitely a form in a good, period. It's a golden period for documentary filmmaking right now. So you mentioned a mix of, new names and familiar names, which is great. Another thing that, that Sofia Meetings is renowned for. Okay, so we're running out of time, Mira, but I wanted to ask you the inevitable final question, especially given the times that we're living in and the way in which the last year's edition differed from this year's edition of Sofia Meetings. What are your hopes for the future?
I'm very optimistic for the future. I think that challenges bring us together as people and make us reflect on the things that we daily experience in a completely different way. It makes us closer. sharing the troubles. It makes us closer. So I totally believe that there will be great stories coming out of this, not necessarily connected with all the restrictions. It is just the matters of sensitivity. Once you manage to change your point of view to reflect in a different way, so I'm total optimist. And I'm optimist in a sense, what I was talking a bit earlier, that the people will be back in the cinemas, because this is experience. This is experience of togetherness, contemplating together art.
So you are hoping for a physical edition of Sophia Meetings in 2022.
Oh, definitely. Actually, you know what? We managed to have the festival, Sophia Film Festival, happen in real time. We even managed to give the awards in the big National Palace of Culture Hall, which is usually, of course, it has like 4,000 seats capacity, but now operating on the 1/3 of the capacity, it was like 1,000.
Right.
But we were lucky enough. Yeah. Yes.
Yes. Totally with you. I think that the future of cinema is also getting people back to the cinemas right now, thinking of the immediate future. But Mira, it's been an absolute pleasure speaking with you again. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Matt. Always pleasure.
Fred Film Radio.
Fred Film Radio.
Cinephile, welcome to a brand new edition of the Dictionary of Film, where each week I choose a term and expand on it by giving out a definition and examples that will help you have a better understanding of various aspects of the filmmaking language, film industry, and so on. And even if you know what these terms mean, it's just a bit of fun to go over them again. This is the third installment of the series, and it's for the letter C. And for this letter, I have chosen to expand on the term cameo, which simply refers to a brief appearance or voiceover part of a well-known person in a work of the performing arts, including, of course, the movies. I'm sure you will have noticed these short uncredited appearances in a movie before. These roles are generally small, many of them non-speaking ones, and are commonly either appearances in a work in which they hold some special significance, such as actors from an original movie appearing in its remake, or renowned people making unaccredited appearances. It's often done just for fun or as a publicity stunt. There are a couple of well-known ones, including Stan Lee appearing in several of the Marvel movies. Directors have also given themselves little cameo roles, like Martin Scorsese in Taxi Driver, Roman Polanski in Chinatown. But the director who is best associated with this practice is easily Alfred Hitchcock, the Hitch himself, whose brief inventive appearances have become legendary. It's almost a cinephile game to spot them with every one of his films. The first of these apparently is to be found in his third film, his silent film masterpiece, The Lodger, a story of the London fog from 1927, where he sits at a newsroom desk. He's also seen in a newspaper ad for a dietary supplement of sorts in Lifeboat from 1944. The last of his cameos is featured in his very last film, Family Plot, from 1976. We see his unmistakable silhouette, which he may or may not have copyrighted, behind the door at the Registrar of Births and Deaths. I'm surprised that in 2021 there is no dedicated website to the art of the cameo appearance, but that's just another fun term that we have explored today. I could have gone the route of the close-up, which in my opinion is the most cinematic shot of all and also happens to begin with the letter C. But maybe if we get to the end of the dictionary and we continue to get the positive responses that you have been pigeon carrying all the way to us these past few days, we'll begin again from the letter A. I have no problem doing that. Hope you enjoyed that one, cinephile. Back for more in a moment.
Fred.
Joining me at this time is Martin Thorsson, director of Backyard Village, a new Icelandic film that recently premiered at Santa Barbara's Nordic Cinema Competition. That's where it had its US premiere. Martin, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
We are going to be talking about Backyard Village, which revolves around the meeting of two broken souls. This is just a short introduction to make sure that we don't leave any listeners out who have not seen the film yet. It revolves around the meeting between two broken souls, a man and a woman, at a guest house in a remote, or at least it looked like it was a remote, small town in Iceland to me. But both are going through traumatic experiences and problems in their lives, and their connection with one another will prove to be quite important during this difficult time. This is just a short intro, like I said. We'll get into it a bit more. But where I wanted to start off, Martin, is I've seen your previous film, XL. Stylistically, this is a very different from that one, right?
Yeah, it's on the opposite end of the spectrum. But that also has to do with, you always, when you're starting a project, you like, what's the point of view of the camera or of the storytelling? And in XL, it was pretty much all from the POV of the protagonist, because there I wanted to get into the mindset of that alcoholic mindset, and show it from his perspective. It was about a corrupt politician in Iceland, this one I wanted to, and it was fast, it was partying, it was drinking, it was cocaine, it was, you know, all kinds of things happening. But this is a more of a meditative approach, where I'm sort of looking at the characters from the outside, and they're, they're unassuming people who want to kind of not be noticed. And so the camera treats them as such. And I think every project calls for a point of view that the director chooses. I mean, where do you put the camera? Why do you put it there? And how does it relate to the story and the storytelling?
Obviously, for you as a filmmaker, then it's also about exploring different types of filmmaking. I mean, you're very willing to explore different cinematic languages, different ones, like the one that you used in XL and the one that you use in Backyard Village.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I love playing around with the format of film, and to experiment. And I would love to experiment more, because one of the reasons why I fell in love with film was that it has so many options in terms of storytelling. And I think we should be doing sort of more experiments. I mean, because a lot of the stuff, for instance, that you see on the big SVOD services or on the internet now, because everything is pretty much going that way, is that you tend to feel like, for instance, Netflix and Apple and those providers, the brand starts to become pretty apparent. And the sort of same mode of storytelling, the sort of the same tempo, the same texture in sound and in visuals and all that. And I feel like we could be going back in many ways to like the 70s, for instance. I love Netflix and I watch a lot of stuff there, but you know, I got a bit tired of it the other day, and I found The Passenger, Antonioni, you know. And it was so refreshing. It was so refreshing just to feel, you know, the different tempo, the different sensibilities, something that didn't really fit into the formula we're using today in a lot of entertainment.
Right. Yeah, that's a good point. You know, I even on this very show, I often complain about Netflix. So you're right up my alley there. But just going back to the film, Backyard Village, we talked about the style a little bit, but what was the starting point for the story?
The starting point for the story, it started actually not with the story. It started with the setting. It started with, because I wanted to make a movie, first of all. I haven't made a movie in a while. And you know, you have several projects going on, and some of them are, you know, get financed and stuff. But we wrote, me and my partner, Gudmundur Óskarsson, we decided to write a story into this setting of the Backyard Village. Incidentally, it is a place that I own along with my wife. We've had tourists there, but it's a free location, and it's in my town, and it's. So we started thinking, okay, what could we make for X amount of kronas? And And so we're like, okay, we can have two people, maybe two lead actors, and we can shoot most of it here, and we have X many days. And okay, so how can we fit a story into that? And then what are we interested in? What sort of pressing? And that, and I have had myself experiences with, you know, anxiety and depression and loss and all those kinds of things. And I, you know, said to Gumi, you know, how can we create a character who is dealing with anxiety, you know, meets someone, a tourist here, and he's dealing with something else, like a loss or something like that. And then it came from that. And the story came pretty quickly. And it's a simple story, but it focuses on like human interaction and connection and how we need as human animals to have intimacy and touch and talk about things and instead of, you know, just sort of burying them down into the neither regions of the mind where, you know, you never know how they're going to turn out later in your life, how they're going to affect you.
But it is a place that you like to explore too, right? I mean, you, like you talked about how, and I suspected it, how the location itself was a starting point for you in this project. But, you know, exploring those regions of the mind, I feel like is an area of interest for you when you're developing your films, your narratives.
Yeah, it is. And I mean, it may be in the beginning when you're sort of starting out, it's not necessarily something that you realize, but I've been sort of going back to, like, this is my fourth movie, and I was looking at 1.0, which is like a sci-fi mindfuck film that was financed in Los Angeles, and then it's Rockland, and then XL, and then this one. And yeah, there is a thread of, you know, the need for human contact, the need for friendship, the need for, you know, and the loneliness. All these elements are apparent in all my movies. So, yeah, I guess I'm really interested in that. Maybe I just need a hug.
Right. And it's difficult. And it's interesting to talk about hugs and human contact at a time when essentially in various many parts of the world, these are things that have been lacking because of the pandemic, right?
Yeah, I know. And as it turns out, like, it, you know, this thing happens with the COVID, and it's almost bizarre to look at the movie now. It's like it's from a different time. It's from a, but there, I think there's never been more sort of need, exactly. I mean, I think a lot of people are isolated and alienated, and we still haven't seen the sort of what's going to come out of it psychologically for people.
Right. Absolutely.
And I hope the movie speaks to that, to people.
I think so. Yeah. So I seem to understand you're not a believer, or not that much of a believer, that virtual contact can replace human contact, to put it bluntly.
No, I mean, it can, I think for a while, I think, and for instance, I mean, it has given me an opportunity, for instance, to connect with people, friends living abroad, whether they're in Australia or Los Angeles or England or Japan or whatnot. And probably I'm more in touch with a lot of my friends, you know, more than before. But at the end of the day, I would much rather see them in person. I mean, meetings and stuff, you know, something that's related to your business, you know, people can do a lot of things and probably a lot more efficiently via Zoom or the channels that we have available for us. But at the end of the day, we're a social animal, and we thrive on touch and intimacy.
We'll be right back in a moment.
Fred Film Radio.
We're back with filmmaker Martin Thorsen, director of Backyard Village. And Martin, in one of your earlier answers, you mentioned the term timeless. And that's incidentally what I felt your film was like. It may also have been because of the landscape and setting where the film takes place, which definitely lends it that atmosphere. But just generally speaking, are you aware of that? And did you strive to achieve that sense of timelessness for Backyard Village?
I think I try to do that in all my work. I feel like movies or most works of art are, you know, stronger when they speak to the... I mean, the human condition doesn't change that much. What changes is the world around us, the world that we're creating. But the basic human needs and instincts are the same and as they were, you know, 300 years ago or 1,000 years ago. It's we need the same things. We need love, we need food, we need you know, interaction, intimacy, like I've said many times now. And I think also the films will live longer, you know. Yeah, I think that's something that I try to do in my movies, to make them sort of timeless. I mean, this can happen anytime, except maybe in COVID. It's pretty much, it sets a certain perimeter.
Sure. Returning to the point about interaction and connection, which is obviously very important in your film, but how do you achieve that? How do you work with the actors in order to achieve a realistic representation of that? Because one of the things that I felt was very, was great about this film is that there is a sense of realism when you're watching these two lead characters connect. You don't necessarily think that it's not real. It almost feels authentic. So that's something that is done very rarely in cinema when we see things like that. And I was wondering whether you did something to encourage that type of representation or to help the actors work in that way.
Oh, wow. This is, I mean, of course, you need good actors.
Well, let's name them and pay tribute to them. What are their names?
Yeah, Tim Plaster, whom I was introduced to me by a mutual friend, Ólafur Darri Ólafsson, who's an actor in Iceland, and he'd been working with Tim on I think it was a BBC Viking series or 1660, I think it was called. They worked together on that, and Tim was coming to Iceland, and we hooked up. We had dinner at my house, and of course, this is in 2011, and we start talking about, you know, doing stuff together, and you know, that like people do, and usually nothing comes out of it, but you know, 1% or 2% of instances that happens. And when we were writing the script, you know, I showed Gumi, who wrote was credited with the screenplay. I showed him pictures of Tim, and so we had him in mind when we were writing it. I hadn't found the character of Brynja, who is the main character, although they pretty much have the same weight. And then I started the casting process for Brynja's character. I sent Tim all the additions because I was trying to, you know, sort of match the actors, both sort of physically and also to find somebody that would, you know, would maybe have sort of a natural connection, because it's the worst thing that you can do, worst thing that can happen, if you're doing a film about two people who are supposed to, you know, connect, is that there is actually no connection. No matter how good an actor...
Or too much connection, right?
or too much connection, yeah, exactly.
Because I felt that with this relationship that they shared was also enriched by these little moments of awkwardness that felt very real when it comes to two people getting to know each other for the first time.
Yeah, exactly. And they're both brilliant actors. And we had... I flew Tim in for rehearsals. So, I mean, that's also a big part of it. You need with something like this, you need to be able to rehearse your actors, to discuss the roles, to discuss the underlying themes that are sort of the major themes of the movie. With Loewe, who plays the character of Brynja, she has a history of anxiety disorder, and so we talked about that a lot. And then we discussed with Tim, and Tim was a big part of also in the casting of Loewe. So there was already, you know, there's already, you know, in the first meeting, there was already camaraderie between them. And that's something that you then just build on. And like, that was my biggest fear was, okay, what if they just don't connect at all? I mean, then the film is ruined. It's not going to work. But we got lucky. And I mean, I did everything in my power that I could to exactly sort of create this atmosphere. And it's also because it's a, you know, it's a low budget. It's a very small crew. And I try to create an atmosphere of just family on set, when everybody, you know, is very gung ho, working for little money. So we, not just with those actors, but also with the crew, that we're all in this together, like for real, not like when the politicians are saying it. This time it's sort of, you know, real.
And like you said earlier, this film was shot in your guest house, so that also helps, right?
That helps. And I mean, we you know, my wife, who's a writer, novelist, she just loved, you know, having people here. I mean, our household is very, sometimes like a train station. we got lots of guests. We get lots of people. Of course, we have, you know, we're both working artists. We run this guest house. Everybody here, like, unfortunately, my wife is an artist, so she knows what all this is about. And so everybody joins. Everybody is working towards the same goal. And my daughter is in it. You know, you just you use all the resources you have and do the best you can. Yeah. And the atmosphere is so important. I don't think you need to, in order to create a masterpiece, that you need to be an asshole. I think
no,
you can
definitely
be nice.
All right, Martin. So thanks very much for joining us. It's been a pleasure talking with you.
Thanks for having me. It was a pleasure for me as well.
Fred Film Radio.
In honor of Radu Jude's victory at this year's Sofia International Film Festival, let's revisit Angelo Acerbi's interview with Radu Jude about Uppercase Print. Here's a clip from his interview with the Romanian filmmaker from the 2020 Berlinale.
Basically, you made a film which is part archival and part shooting. And it...
Shooting also of an archival.
Also shooting
of
archival, yeah. And it's... well, basically, it's a story. The story is like, in 1981, there is this... There was this guy and kid, because we're 16 year old, yeah. A kid, that was writing with chalk big anti-government statement on walls and stuff in Bucharest, and you use the fire that was revealed after about all the police statements and interrogation and the investigation on this kid, and you put them on the side with regular TV propaganda production. Why did you choose this specific way of narrative?
Well, I think there's a lot of reasons behind. One of them is it has to do with my desire, my idea, my, I don't know how to call it, to incorporate, to make a cinema, but with materials which doesn't necessarily belong originally to cinema, to show somehow or to explore how cinematic language can expand, can incorporate these things. That's one of the starting points. The other is the fact that the film is about history, recent or not very recent history, and I really think that cinema can have something to say about history, or could have something to say regarding history, only if it finds a specific form to deal with this issue. Because otherwise, I don't know, a book of history could be better, or a cartoon or something like that could much better than a conventional film, so to speak. Yeah. And the third reason is the fact that this, let's say, historical film, which are made in a conventional way, to reconstruct a past era, a past epoch with all the details, so create a kind of realistical, believable idea of the past, I think they're very problematical from this point of view, because, of course, you cannot have access to the past, not even to the yesterday, but less to 100 years or 50 years ago. So all these things came together in my desire to make this film in this way, so to shoot the actors saying the texts which are from the Securitate, the secret police file, which are dry texts, uninteresting maybe sometimes, but also there are a lot of cracks in them that shows how a state oppressive apparatus was operating, was working, and to cross-cut that in a kind of, let's say, Eisensteinian montage with another layer of audiovisual history of remains, of traces from that past, which are the most official images we have, which are the ones broadcasted by the national television of that time.
And how did you work in selecting and then choosing which images of the archival to be shown and which not? Because I believe that you must have screened like thousands of hours of material.
I think 100. Oh, wow. I didn't get to. Actually, my criteria was, first of all, chronological. Mm-hmm. So I selected only the materials that were broadcasted in the same time as the story of the teenager and of his inquisitional trial took place, in order to see exactly in the same time what was under these archival images. So this was one of the criteria. The second one, to be honest, I think was quite, let's say, I invited the chaos, the hazard, how you could call it, the chance to take a part in the construction of the film, because the National Television Archive is in a really bad shape and badly kept, and you don't know which materials they have, actually. Mm-hmm. They are not indexed, they are not cataloged properly. So I just randomly looked at more and more materials, and at some point, when something seemed to me interesting, and by interesting I mean either materials which were so so strange from our time, so different from what's around, that they showed a lost time, a lost world in a way, or on the other hand, on the opposite, I chose sometimes materials which are very relevant even for today. They still have some meaning, of some kind of weird truth even for today. And also materials, images which have, let's say, some cracks in them. I mean by that even if they were made like propaganda, for propaganda reasons, you can see behind exactly how propaganda was constructing them.
Okay. To listen to the full interview, check out fred.fm/UK.
Fred Film Radio.
Fred Film Radio.
Cinephile, we have come to the end of yet another episode of the Big Fred Tuesday, and it has been a pleasure, as usual, having you aboard. We'll be back for more film and conversation next week, but before we say goodbye for now, it's time for our regular popcorn classic segment, where I highlight an alternative cinema title that may serve as a suggestion to help you further your own cinematic explorations and help you earn that coveted black belt in cinephilia. For this week's pick, I am returning to the world of slapstick comedy, and it's not a hidden gem as such, but always worth rediscovering. Chances are that if you are a fan of early silent slapstick comedy, and one of its greatest interpreters of all, Buster Keaton, then you will know this one. It's called Cops, and it's from 1922. And when you think about slapstick comedies, one of their most recurring elements is that of the chase, which often involved less than flattering representations of cops. Let's just say that. And Buster Keaton seemed to be one of the best at using this particular narrative element, and had explored it many times in the films he made prior to Cops. But in this two-reeler, which is really about half an hour in length, it just feels like a culmination of all those gags and the energy of those chases. It's also considered among his best shorts. The narrative itself is way more sophisticated than the common chase short film. It involves an impossible romance, Depression-era hardships, and also anarchy. In fact, it's a bomb thrown by an anarchist that kicks off this epic chase that is the centerpiece of this absolute gem of a short film. The anarchic nature of some of these slapstick comedies, by the way, and in particular those of Buster Keaton, is certainly also the reason why so many of the avant-garde artists regarded him as nothing short of a hero and had a lot of respect for his futurist vision, from which they occasionally actually drew inspiration. Again, this is just a wonderful two-reeler from one of the legendary American slapstick comedians, Buster Keaton. It's called Cops, and he co-directed it with longtime collaborator Edward F. Klein, and it's this week's Popcorn Classic. And that's it for this week's Big Fred Tuesday. Don't forget that there is plenty more content for you to sink your ears into across all the channels, all the various channels on Fred.fm, in multiple languages too. And again, I will be back next week with some more BFT goodness, but till the next time, stay healthy, stay safe, stay strong, stay cinephile, and stay tuned to Fred Film Radio, the Festival Insider.
Fred.
This is Cristiana Palmieri for Fred Film Radio from the Sydney Film Festival.
My name is Roberto Pombo, here on Fred Film Radio, the Festival Insider.
Io sono Laura Buffa e questa è una nuova puntata di Fred Mag.
Mein Name ist Beatrice Bieden und ich spreche mit Andreas Puchaska.
Fred, the Festival Experience in 23 languages.
Fred Film Radio,
24/7 on Fred.fm and smartphone apps.